Thank you all for coming out tonight. Tonight we are going to hear from Dr. Phil Lawler on why the Catholic Revival will begin in New England. This is our third lecture here at the center. Our next one will be on June 15th at Mount Royal in Sunapee, New Hampshire, on St. John Chrysostom's sermon on young boys. So please help me welcome Phil Lawler, who is a world-class author who has published several important works for our day. His essays and book reviews have appeared in dozens of magazines, including National Review, Crisis, The Critic, 30 Days, Modern Age, Policy Review, American Spectator, and First Things. His columns have appeared in over 100 newspapers around the United States and abroad, including the Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, Boston Globe, and Wall Street Journal. Please welcome Phil Lawler tonight. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming out on a beautiful day. We haven't had many of them recently.
No.
One of the things that Dominic didn't say, and it's okay, I'm not looking for more biographical information, but what he didn't say, possibly because he's heard the joke I'm about to tell, and so he didn't give me the setup line, that I was the first lay editor of the Boston Pilot, which is the newspaper of the Boston Archdiocese. And the Pilot it's an old newspaper. It's the oldest Catholic newspaper in the country. And it had had priests as editor for over 100 years. And when I was editor, naturally some people assumed I was a priest. And I would get phone calls and people would refer to me as Father, and I would let it go because, I mean, you don't want to correct people who are trying to be nice. But every once in a while, I'd be in a crabby mood. My wife will confirm that if you have any doubts. And there was one time where I got a call from a nice lady who was calling me Father this and Father that. And finally I said, you know, it's not Father. And I'm sure there was annoyance in my voice. I didn't mean it, but it was one of those days. And I heard a gasp on the other end of the line. Oh, I'm sorry, Monsignor. So, I'm not a Monsignor. I found that lady's attitude, again, a very nice lady making a very nice point, and I should have been nicer to her, but her attitude bespoke something about an attitude towards the Catholic Church. An attitude that if you were acting in any way as a spokesman for the Church, you must be a priest. That there's no way a Catholic layman would be speaking on behalf of the Catholic Church. It was an attitude that should have been jettisoned long, long ago. I'd almost say it was a pre-concilia attitude, except that phrase has connotations these days that I don't necessarily want to get into. But an attitude that the Second Vatican Council sought to eliminate. When the Vatican Council proclaimed that this is the age of the laity. Now, the odd thing is we don't think of Vatican II as proclaiming the age of the laity. We think of Vatican II as changing the order of the Mass. And when we think of the results of Vatican II, other than the liturgical results, we think of priests and religious coming off the altar, out of the monasteries, to work in the secular world, the lay world, leaving lay people to act as Eucharistic ministers, doing the work of priests. This is not the age of the laity. So I want to talk a little bit at the beginning of this talk about what the age of the laity means, what the real spirit of Vatican II is, as opposed to the ersatz spirit that you hear invoked so often to such ill effect. The greater problem about Vatican II, about the implementation of Vatican II, the reason we don't hear much about the age of the laity today is how badly the work of the Council has been interpreted, how it's been distorted through the mass media, through the work of Catholic theologians and philosophers and, yes, Catholic journalists, so that we see constantly people citing Vatican II to support positions diametrically opposed to what the documents of the Council actually say. How did this happen? It's an odd thing when any institution has its leaders get together for a conference, and after they've got together, there's more confusion than there was beforehand. How did that happen? I think it's time, 50 years after the Council, to acknowledge that there is confusion. And there is room for confusion in some of the documents, but far more room for confusion in the way people have interpreted the documents. And how did that happen? Well, at the Council, as at any meeting of any institution, there were differences of opinion. What happened was that people of one opinion succeeded to a large extent in capturing the media coverage, both during and after the Council. The people of another opinion succeeded to a large extent in controlling the documents of the Council. So that you had the documents of the Council saying relatively unsurprising things, and the coverage of the Council suggesting that the documents were much more radical in their impact. As a result, the general perception of Vatican II is that it was a radical break from Catholic tradition. My favorite explanation of how this happened, and bear with me if I quote from a book by Philip Trauer called Turmoil and Truth. And he explains how it can be that when you have two different modes of interpretation of the Council, and one of them wants to go much further than the Council, how is it that the one that wants to go much further rules the day in the popular perception? Philip Trauer explains with an image which I have been unable to outdo. Here from Turmoil and Truth. Six men are pushing a heavily loaded car which has run out of fuel. Three of them, who have been riding in the car, want to push it 20 yards to get it to a lay-by. The other three, who have offered to help, mean to push the car 50 yards and shove it over a cliff, followed by the car owner and his two friends. Once the pushing begins and the car starts moving, it is probable that the car is going to come to rest more than 20 yards from the starting point, even if it doesn't end up at the cliff's foot. Now, let us imagine what a group of people watching from a nearby hilltop will make of the incident. They will start by assuming that all six men have the same intention. The car is moving steadily forward. Then they see three of these men detach themselves from the back of the car, run around to the front, and try to stop it. Which are the troublemakers? Those, surely, who are now opposing the progress that has been started. You see how this works, that the progress that was started at Vatican II, which was only intended to go 25 yards, looks now to the world as if it should continue for 50 yards over the cliff. But I digress. I was talking about the age of the laity, which, if you study the documents of Vatican II, is as strong a motif as you'll find anywhere. And I was talking about how the inversion of that idea of the age of the laity was found in the assumption that I was a Monsignor. The old idea being that the lay people worked to support the priest and religious on the front lines. The new idea, which is actually the classic idea of the Catholic Church, is that it's the laity on the front lines, and the religious, the priests and religious, their duty is to give the laity the support they need on the front lines. Rather a reverse, you see, an inversion of the clericalist idea. And by the way, do you see how wrong it is to put the clergy on the front lines? That's not where they belong. It's us. It's the laity. That's our job. Evangelization is the job of the laity. The job of the priest and the religious is to give us the spiritual sustenance that we need to go out and preach the gospel. Cardinal John Henry Newman made the point that after any major council of the church, there's a period of turmoil, then recovery and recognition of the themes of the council. And I think we're right about on schedule, 50 years after the council. We've had the turmoil. I hope we are now moving towards the age of recovery and recognition. And that's my theme for this evening. I believe that we are on schedule to begin the age of the laity, which was proclaimed by the bishops 50 years ago. That's my first historical theory for the night, and let me give you another one. This is more ambitious. I'm trying to give you a sense of my sense of where we stand in the history of the church. And if you think about it, the people who are living in an era of great change don't necessarily see the drama the way we do today. That is, we put labels on eras. We call one era the Renaissance or the Enlightenment or the Great Awakening. But the actors in those dramas, the actors of those times were pursuing their own goals, their own ideas, their own family lives, their own professions, not knowing how history would judge them, not knowing whether or not their ideals would prevail. The committees of correspondence in the 13 American colonies weren't originally set up to found the United States of America. That term, the United States of America, was not known at the time. They wanted to vindicate their rights as Englishmen. Their ideas caught hold, and historical forces shaped their lives in ways that they could not have predicted. So we look back and talk about them as the founding fathers of the United States. They wouldn't have recognized that term when they began their work. I believe that we're at a similar period in time, in history, a time of profound change. The systems of government, the nation state, not just here, around the world, are teetering, threatened by forces that are on the one hand global, the global market, the global reach of Islam, global migration, particularly in Europe and Africa. We think of migration from Latin America, but we're in the minor leagues in comparison to Europe and Africa. The ubiquitous power of the media and the world of instant communication and the internet. These global forces are shaping our future. And at the same time, there are disorganized and almost chaotic forces, the separatist movements, the nationalist movements, the Antifa and Wall Street, Occupy Wall Street, almost anarchic forces at work to break down our assumptions about how society works. What's going to emerge from these huge collisions of historic forces? We don't know. Someone 100 or 200 years ago, years in the future, will have a much better understanding of what's happening, of what we're doing, a better understanding of what we're doing than we have ourselves in terms of its historic scope. But my thesis is that what we are now seeing beginning to develop is precisely the age of the laity, the age of the Catholic laity. I say this partly because there's only one alternative that I see possible, and that is the utter collapse of our society, of our civilization. The pendulum of historical change has been swinging since you choose. Is it since the Enlightenment, since the French Revolution, since Descartes, Machiavelli? It's been swinging on one long arc in roughly the same direction, away from faith toward secularization, away from revelation toward reliance on unassisted, arrogant reason. At the same time, paradoxically, away from dispassionate argument toward emotional claims. The next result of the changes in thought over the past generations has been thoroughly to undermine the ideas on which our polity and our culture are built. So our situation is unsustainable. We don't agree. We can't find a way to reach agreement. Dialogue is fruitless because there's no common ground. This situation is unsustainable. At this point, I hope you're not going to charge me with being excessively optimistic in what I'm saying. But as long as I've got to what might be the low point in terms of the cheeriness of my talk, let me tell you that I see an opportunity here. A Marxist or a Leninist would say, heighten the contradictions. Or someone more practical might say, it's easier to see your adversaries. Or was it Colonel Chesty Puller who said when he was surrounded, this is wonderful, we can attack in any direction. Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, the future Pope Benedict, spoke of his hope for a creative minority of Catholics, acknowledging that the church might shrink in size, but saying it's precisely when we're small, when we're lean and mean, that we are most creative, we have most impact on society. That's a nicer way of referring to a very old Catholic bit of wisdom, that the blood of martyrs is the future of the church. We're meeting tonight on the feast of St. Justin Martyr, a student of philosophy, a man of great wisdom, but his influence is all the greater, not because he continued in his philosophical work, but because he died, or more importantly, because he was prepared to die, to sacrifice his life rather than to sacrifice his principles. Put that phrase about the blood of martyrs in economic terms. Martyrs invest in the faith, and investment reaps dividends. It's not predictable how it will reap dividends. Obviously, the martyrs don't live to see how it will reap dividends. But the faith flourishes because there are martyrs. Why? For two reasons. First, their witness stirs other people and enkindles the faith. Second, and I think we tend to forget this, because they achieve something real through grace. Grace is real, and the sacrifice they make is real and brings real effects. Harder to measure, harder to predict, even harder to notice, but real. Now, I'm not going to suggest that there are many martyrs in the United States today. I'm also not going to suggest that the possibility does not exist, that there couldn't be martyrs in our future. And there is a great deal of white martyrdom, of public antipathy, and it's growing, and people are paying a price for the faith. Some people have already paid a fairly heavy price for the faith, losing their job, being prosecuted, spending time in prison. And I want to tell you a little bit about something that was formative in my life, speaking of spending time in prison. I was involved years ago in Operation Rescue. And, you know, it's odd. Operation Rescue is not noted in the history books much. It is, without dispute, the largest civil rights movement in the history of this country. For those of you who don't know or have forgotten or haven't heard, in the late 80s and early 90s, thousands and thousands of pro-life activists sat down peacefully in front of abortion clinics blocking their doors, forcing the clinics to close, and were arrested and sometimes spent some time in jail. Between 1988 and 1989, think about this. Each of those years, more than 10,000 people were arrested outside abortion clinics. Each year, more than 10,000 arrests. That is dwarfs any other civil rights movements in our country's history, but it's not in the history books. I became involved in Operation Rescue when I was editor of the Pilot, and I heard about this movement that was coming to Boston, and I said, well, gee, I really should cover this. And I went and covered it as a reporter, and I said, those people are doing something that I should be doing. So next time there was a rescue in Boston, I wasn't a reporter, I was arrested. I don't want to overplay my importance. I was a minor figure. I did some public relations for Operation Rescue Boston. I was arrested a few times. I didn't do serious time. Some people did. A good friend of mine did 18 months in prison for a misdemeanor. 18 months in prison for a misdemeanor. In 1991, there was the peak of Operation Rescue nationwide. It was called the Summer of Mercy in Wichita, Kansas. I had the opportunity to go there. And between July and August, more than 2,500 people were arrested in Wichita, mostly at the abortion clinic, notorious clinic run by a man, Dr. George Tiller, an abortion clinic so busy that he had his own crematorium with its smokestack visible for blocks and blocks in any direction. I'm very sorry to say that George Tiller was eventually killed. He was murdered by someone who claimed to be pro-life. It's a horrible thing, and you ask, how can you kill in cold blood in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ? He was killed at a Lutheran church of which he was a respected member. And again, I ask, how can you kill in cold blood in the name of Jesus Christ? But leave that aside. There were 2,600 arrests during the Summer of Mercy before it was closed down. Eventually, Operation Rescue was squashed by draconian penalties and massive lawsuits. There was the Freedom of Access to Clinic bill, which made it such that if you were arrested outside an abortion clinic, you could spend a year in jail. If you were arrested outside a grocery store, there would be no penalty. In fact, there was one funny incident in Boston where people were picketing outside an abortion clinic, and the police forced them to move away from the clinic. So they moved just far enough so that they were sort of blocking the entrance to a music store next door to the clinic. And the proprietor of the music store complained to the police, and the police said, there's nothing we can do. You're only selling pianos. Along with the Freedom of Access law, there were RICO lawsuits. That's racketeering and influence and corrupt organization lawsuits. And my little claim to fame, I was a defendant in a RICO lawsuit. It was alleged that I had been engaged in a conspiracy. I was guilty. But the lawsuit, fortunately, was thrown out of court. My point in telling these stories is that during these times, a lot of people made real sacrifices. A lot of people made real commitments. And let me tell you something else. Do you know what we were doing when we were sitting or kneeling or standing outside abortion clinics? And do you know what we were doing when we were in jail? We were praying. And those prayers were real. Grace is real. Something happened. An investment was made. A heavy investment was made. I'm still waiting to see how that investment pays off. I believe that we will see it. I'm not sure where and when, but I can tell you this much. We have already seen some of the investment from the Summer of Mercy in Wichita, because of those 2,600 people who were arrested there, three now have a very unusual way of life. They're bishops of the Catholic Church. 3 bishops were arrested in Wichita that summer. I mean, they were young men then, young laymen. They're bishops now. Well, our situation today is bleak by most of the normal measures. If you look at the standard statistics for the Catholic Church, you see a decline in number of mass attendance, a decline in religious vocations, and so forth. You see a rising opposition. You see an increasing hostility, public hostility. You see a greater and greater apathy so that people aren't married in the church, aren't baptizing their children. All this, those statistics look terrible. And sometimes I wonder, are we looking in the right places? Because if we're looking for a renewal of the church, maybe we shouldn't be looking for the mega statistics. Maybe we should be looking for where is that? Where's the leaven? And as a journalist covering Catholic affairs now for, longer than I'd like to confess, more than 40 years now, I keep finding signs of hope in all the funniest places. Just for instance, I've been trying since sometime in the 80s to get to Mass every day. It's been my experience, living in 6 different places over the years, in 7 different parishes and chapels, that the number of people coming to daily Mass always increases, despite the fact that it's a relatively old group, and some of them disappear to Florida or nursing homes or more permanent addresses. But the number keeps increasing. My favorite example of unexpected surge in Catholic influence is EWTN, Mother Angelica. Explain that to me. Who would have thought that a goofy nun from Ohio would found the largest Catholic media enterprise in the world? She had no background. There's nothing on her resume to suggest that she would succeed. She had no money. She had nothing. But she succeeded. Look at the rise in Eucharistic adoration in parishes. And I've developed the habit over in recent years of telling people and challenging people about Eucharistic adoration. I tell people that I have never heard of a parish that began Eucharistic adoration that didn't have wonderful things happen in the parish. Now, I'll warn you, the wonderful things that happen are very often not the wonderful things you were praying to happen. They're different. But wonderful things always happen. And I've challenged people. Tell me of an instance where it hasn't happened. Nobody's met that challenge yet. The pro-life movement, which I mentioned, the sacrifice that people have made. Homeschooling. Another investment that so many people, mostly young mothers, make at enormous cost to themselves. They invest in the future of their children. My old publisher, Father Joseph Fessio, who's the founder of Ignatius Press, has made the point that he thinks that the home schools today are the equivalent of the Irish monasteries in the Dark Ages, that they are preserving the kernel. There's the seed corn. People are making choices. They're making sacrifices. They're not just waiting. This is the age of the laity in action. The Catholic Church today is recovering from an awful time. And nowhere more awful than in the United States, the scandal that has hit us in the early 21st century. I guess it was in the early 90s, I was on a radio program. My friend Al Cresta asked me about the sex abuse scandal, which was just beginning to poke its nose out of the tent then in the early 90s. And he asked me, do I think this is a big deal? And he has since told me, he expected me to say, no, this is a big deal. This is an isolated thing. This is not going to amount to much. And I told him, I think that this will be the most serious crisis for the Catholic Church since the Reformation. In retrospect, I'm looking prophetic there. If I'm right, I think I am right. That underlines my point that we're living in a historic time for the church. Now, I don't want to go through the whole history of the scandal. Believe me, I don't want to go through the whole history of the scandal. I've gone through it so often in so many different venues, in so many different publications, in three different books at this point. But let me just say, in very brief, my theory on how it happened. It's twofold. There were bad priests who did bad things. That's terribly unfortunate, but very easy to understand. Where the Catholic Church understands sin. We're all sinners. We know about bad people, therefore we know about bad priests. And that evil has been, to a large extent, addressed. The number of these incidents has gone down very significantly since 2000. In fact, since about 1980. It peaked in the 70s. It's gone down since then. But that's the first part of the scandal. The second part of the scandal is that bishops lied to the faithful. Bishops betrayed the trust of the faithful. That is more shocking and more corrosive. First, because we didn't expect it. We had no armament. we couldn't put it into a category. We couldn't say, oh, sinners, got it, people like me, I understand. We couldn't understand why bishops would protect the predators rather than the prey, the innocent people. And worse, we were, for the first time, I think, seriously challenged, tempted to say, we can't trust our bishops. And if you can't trust your bishops, how can you receive the faith? Because they are the teachers of the faith. If you can't trust bishops as primary teachers, what's left to trust? It was a terrible blow to the church. And I asked myself, since I knew some of the bishops involved, I was working for Cardinal Law, who's come out of this looking like the primary bad guy in the story, and I knew him. He was not a bad man. He did bad things. He was not a bad man. Why did he do this? Why did so many bishops protect the predators rather than the innocent? If you think about it, if a bishop were completely corrupt and selfish, and he found out that a priest was molesting young people, what would he do? For purely selfish motives, he would get rid of that priest. It would make his life easier. But he didn't. Again and again, we found he didn't. Why not? I came to understand that the answer was a very misguided sense of what was good for the church. A sense that what was good for the church was something similar to what's good for the Rotary Club or for some other institution. That you don't want bad publicity. Well, how'd that work out? There are two different images of the church as an institution and as the bride of Christ. And unfortunately, bishops protected the institution and let the bride of Christ be sullied. Now, when you start talking about the institutional church, you're on thin ice because the church is an institution. Our Lord came to establish an institution, the Catholic Church. But it's important, too, to keep things in proper perspective. The way I put it in my book about the faithful departed, I tried to explain the different images of the church by explaining my marriage. I'm married to a wonderful woman, Lila, and she's the love of my life, and she's my better half, and she gives me all my good ideas. And the only reason I write more books than she does is that I type faster. She's smarter. And I'm in love with her, and it's been 40 years, and it's just getting better. Now, that's one part. She is also the woman who cooks for me every day and does the laundry, right? And those are real things and keeps the house. And you can see Is Lila the woman who's the love of my life, or is she the one who does the laundry? She's both. But if I start thinking of her exclusively as the one who does the laundry, you see that the problem that's going to develop? That's the institutional church. There is the institution. It's a real thing. But when you think of it to the exclusion of the mystical, the supernatural, you're in trouble. What we learned through the scandal is that bishops, by trying to preserve the influence of the church, by trying to avoid bad publicity, by trying to avoid a scandal, created a host of bad publicity, and crippled the influence of the church. And there is another lesson to be learned here for the church, that the church doesn't play defense very well. When you're trying to protect the church from the outside, playing defense, you end up eviscerating the church from within. What bishops, and not just bishops, church leaders, priests, religious, teachers in Catholic schools, and ourselves as lay people need to learn is not to play defense, not to try to make the teachings of the church, the discipline of the church, more acceptable to the world on the world's terms, not to mute the tough teachings in order to gain popularity and, yes, to gain money. They're coming after me. Not to discourage the hardcore Catholics, the ones who want to do a bit more. When you do that, you have an unhappy result. You lose the internal cohesion of the church. So you want the church to be more politically viable. What happens is you get a church that's a mile wide and an inch deep and doesn't have the cohesion, doesn't have the power to carry. To put it in political terms, Catholics vote, and campaign strategists devote a great deal of time to their plans for appealing to those voters. But today, there is no Catholic vote. Catholics are all over the place voting. We have a great paradox. When the church sacrifices the integrity of doctrine for popular influence, she loses both the integrity and the influence. St. Thomas More, at his death, had more public influence than all the English bishops, all but one of whom knuckled under to the pressure of Henry VIII. Are Christians today called to emulate Thomas More? Yes. To martyrdom? Don't rule it out. To sacrifice? Certainly. Certainly in the current climate, unwillingness to sacrifice, to stand up against the prevailing winds and accept the consequences is unwillingness to bear witness to the gospel. In my lifetime, the greatest political event that I have seen was the fall of the Berlin Wall. I could have told you that I thought, no. I would have said that I knew that the Soviet Union could not be defeated without a protracted and costly struggle. But in the end, it was. What caused the downfall of that powerful regime? The withdrawal of public support. No government, no matter how powerful, no matter how ruthless, can survive when the public refuses to recognize its legitimacy. As a footnote, I think we're skating on the edge of this problem in the United States today, with some people who refuse to recognize President Trump as a legitimate president, and others quite ready to return the favor. But back to the Soviet Union. An essay that has powerfully formed my thinking on the question of public witness was Alexander Solzhenitsyn's Live Not by Lies, dated the day of his exile from Russia. It's a powerful witness, and I urge you to read it. Just one line, one quick quotation from Solzhenitsyn, and I do recommend you read the whole essay. It's just a short op-ed piece. But he says, the simplest and most accessible key to our self-neglected liberation lies right here, personal non-participation in lies. Though lies conceal everything, though lies embrace everything, but not with any help from me. What he said was the Soviet regime lived by lies. It lived by people pretending to believe Marxist-Leninist propaganda, by people pretending to respect the quotas that come down from the government farm bureau, pretending to believe the propaganda that was churned out, pretending to honor the people who were put forward for honor by the Communist Party. And those lies mount up and take on a life of their own. But when you refuse, when you cancel your subscription to the Communist Party journal, when you stop clapping for silly officials' appearance, and so forth, you suck the legitimacy out of the regime. Solzhenitsyn, of course, was one of those people who paid a very high price, and he acknowledged that not everyone could do what he did. Some are not ready to make the sacrifices for themselves, for their families, for other reasons. He accepts that, but he says, don't feed the beast. Don't subscribe to the newspaper that you know will print falsehoods. Don't stand and applaud for the functionary who has done nothing. We should do that, especially young people. Now, decide where you'll draw the line before you're tempted to cross over where that line might have been. Can you say now, we will not support politicians who accept abortion, euthanasia, etc.? Can we say we will not send our children to public schools or to elite colleges where their faith and their sanity and their health is in danger? That we won't go with our friends to the strip clubs? That we'll change jobs if the company begins doing something immoral, even if it costs a pension? That we'll move because we can't find support in the community? I'm married to Lila today in part because her father decided to move out of New York because he felt that his sons were hanging around with the wrong kind of street gangs. Or, are you ready to take a greater step? Are you ready to run for office? Are you ready to start a school? You may pay a price when you take these steps. No, you will pay a price when you take these steps. Not only the price of starting a school, which is expensive, you might not get the job you wanted. You might not be invited to the parties you'd like to attend. You might be called names, or worse. If you're going to take that step, you must have a support system. You must have a parish where you can find the sacraments, the sacramental sustenance that you need without fighting for it constantly. You need friends that you can trust. You need friends with whom your children can play, friends with whom you can compare notes, relax. You need a spiritual life, a life of prayer. And you need habits of prayer so that it happens not just in church, but everywhere. The goal, ultimately, is to go beyond the negative, the live not by lies, and to do something positive, to proclaim the truth, because the truth has power. We are a minority, but we can be a creative minority. The great question that I think faces the church today, or in any era, but certainly today, is, are we influenced by the culture, or are we influencing the culture? For sure, it's a two-way street, but which way is most of the traffic facing? Are we making the culture, or is the culture making the church? Because, you know, sometimes when I'm talking about the problems the church is facing, someone will tell me, well, yeah, but, you know, the church can't grow because the culture is so hostile. And you ask yourself, well, why is the culture so hostile? Isn't the church in the business of the cult, which forms the culture? So if the culture is hostile, why? It's because the church has not done what the church should do to form the culture. And think of how the church has done so much to form culture. And think of how it began with the 12 apostles, uneducated, without resources, without consultants, without the internet, without PowerPoint. They had no programs, but they swept the world. Saint Benedict thought he was withdrawing from the world to pray, but he changed the face of Europe entirely. It's a tall order that I'm laying out today, but it can be done. The 12 apostles did it. There's no reason, if you believe in the Holy Spirit's ongoing work in the life of the church, there's no reason it couldn't be done today. Christianity sells. And if sales are down, the problem isn't the product, the problem is the salesman. Or, to quote the great line from the philosopher Pogo, we have met the enemy and he is us. And nowhere more so than here in New England. Think about New England. The last three states with a Catholic majority were Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and Connecticut. Today, it would be hard-pressed to find three states so thoroughly enmeshed in the politics of the culture of death. Catholics were once a majority in those states. Now, in each of those states, the greatest single religious faction is ex-Catholics. And if you think it's hard to convert Muslims, I think it's harder to convert ex-Catholics to the Catholic faith, to bring people, ex-Catholics, back, because they become so complacent, dabbling with the faith while bowing to the ideology, taking of the faith what they like, showing up at Christmas and Easter and maybe for a wedding, less frequently these days, while sacrificing to the false gods of the secular ideology. But the pendulum has swung too far. Physics sets limits on how far it will swing. And logic sets limits on how far the ideology of secularism can swing before it swings back, perhaps violently, and frankly, that's something that worries me. And perhaps it swings back too far in a direction that gives us pause, but for now, let's concentrate on the positive, that it has to swing back because it has reached a limit. There is a limit to what normal people will accept. There is a limit to what lies people will swallow. And if there is any limit to what you will accept, we are approaching that limit, aren't we? When there are insults not just to your faith, but to your intelligence, when you are asked by secular ideology to accept things that you know and have known since you were 3 years old are wrong. You knew when you were three that there's a difference between a boy and a girl, and you knew how to figure it out. It's an injustice to your intelligence. It's an injustice to your family. It's an injustice to science, done in the name of science. Supposedly the basis for this rational thought that we worship today, and yet scientific realities are cast aside. The pendulum will swing back. It's the question that the challenge for us is to guide it as it swings. And here, I believe, to get to the point of my talk, the United States is the place where the pendulum will swing back because we are ripe for reform, because the laity, having endured 15 years of increasing frustration, are ready, anxious, and demanding to take action, anxious for reform, ready to pay the price. We've already paid much of the price. We have a tradition of lay involvement in the United States greater than in Europe. We have a history of working in the secular culture. Remember, the United States was never a Catholic country. There's no other predominantly Christian country that was never, well, maybe Australia, that was never a Catholic country. We have always been a minority here. We have always had the opportunity to be 11. Father Richard Newhouse wrote a great book years ago about the Catholic moment. And he argued, I thought very convincingly in the 80s, that we had reached the Catholic moment. Well, he wrote too soon, but I do believe the Catholic moment is coming. So when does the reform start and where does it start? Well, my argument, it starts in New England. Why? First, because of history. Think about the history of New England, founded by Puritan reformers. The Great Awakening took its, not beginnings here, but it really caught fire in New England. The American Revolution took root here. The abolitionist movement took its roots in Massachusetts, in New England. Bear with me. The Prohibition movement. The first temperance society was founded in Connecticut. Maine was the first state to ban alcohol. By the way, when I ran against Ted Kennedy in 2000, the Prohibition Party endorsed me. We do disagree on one political issue. I don't want to get into it. Now, bad stuff has happened in New England, too. I mean, Massachusetts is the first place, the first state to acknowledge homosexual marriage. And I was speaking earlier about how far the pendulum has swung, how there are so many offenses against faith and reason. So my suggestion is we live not by lies, that we deny the legitimacy of the regime, and it will crumble, more so because it's so obviously wrong. The question then is, who will take the lead? Who will take a stand? Who will give the pendulum the push, if it needs, to push it back towards the center and towards sanity? It has to be somebody, someone or some institution, with a base outside the secular culture. It has to be someone or some institution with an intellectual frame of reference outside the Enlightenment. It has to be someone or some institution with confidence in a grasp on truth and a judgment whereby to acknowledge and recognize the truth. Who is that someone or institution? It is the Catholic Church. That someone is you and me. Now, let me digress a little bit. One of the things that I did, one of the fun moments that I had is I served on the board in Boston of a group of crisis pregnancy centers that were run by Baptist ministers. And one of my jobs on the board was to translate for him from Baptist into Catholic. And I told him, John, when you're talking to a Catholic audience, don't ever say the church needs to help women with crisis pregnancies. Because when Catholics hear the church needs to help, they think the bishops need to help. Somebody there needs to help. In this respect, Protestant language is much better. When you tell Protestants the church needs to help, they hear, oh, that's me, the church. Well, yes, that's us, the church. That's we, the church. So I say the church, why in New England? Because we're going to do it. That's why we founded the Center for the Restoration of Christian Culture at Thomas More College. Because we believe that the time is now and the people is us. The people is we. Why will we do it? Because we have no choice. Because otherwise, what are we going to tell our grandchildren? What are we going to tell them when they ask us what we were doing when society was falling apart? We have to do it because I'm a coward. I don't have the bravery to face my grandchildren and say I was sitting watching TV, watching the Bruins. Do that later tonight. I don't know how long it will take. I'm constantly surprised by how long it's taken already for people to wake up. I don't know how much we'll suffer. I know there will be some suffering. I don't know how much worse things will get before they get better. I suspect they will get worse. It will get worse. But I know that when the time will come, and when it comes, we here in New England must be ready. The road to reform can start here. It can start with us. It can start now. It can start tonight. Thank you.
I have a few questions.
Yes.
Maybe. Part of the reason, I guess part of the reason that I, let me work backwards with your, part of the reason that I believe it has to start in New England is that I live in New England. And I think it's a normal and healthy Christian instinct to love the place where you live, to love your roots. I live in Massachusetts. It's not because I like Massachusetts politics. It's because I'm from I'm a Massachusetts guy. That's where, you know, that's why I talk the way I talk, you know. That's why I think the way I think. Could it be that the South will play a role and maybe even a leading role? It could be. There was a time when I thought that the South would never cave in to the secular culture. And the hearings, the Robert Bork hearings, were where I was disabused of that confidence. But there's no reason the South couldn't be a part of the leaven. The Catholic Church is not as powerful in the South, doesn't have the history in the South, but that today might be an advantage because you don't have the history of mistakes to overcome. You asked about the laws, the protective laws, as I prefer to call them, protecting children and protecting mothers. And I think they are a rallying cry, they are a rallying place for the pro-life movement, which is our cause. It's a fascinating thing because, you know, you had the laws, for instance, in New York and Virginia, which go to the extreme of saying abortion is legal under any circumstances, and if you have to kill the baby after the abortion, that's okay. It's infanticide. And then you have laws in other states that try to put some restrictions on abortion, and everyone says those are the extremists, those people who think that there might be some times when abortion is not a good thing. Those are the extremists. Well, that's crazy. And if we can succeed in convincing people that it's crazy, then we're off to the races. Honestly, I don't know what is the snapping point. What is the point where you snap, where you say, come on, this is ridiculous. I mean, well, you ask yourself, look at where America was in 1970 and where America, well, never mind. Where America was in 2000 and where it is today. You know, Barack Obama, as presidential candidate, said he was opposed to same-sex marriage. Now he would be condemned as a bigot for saying that. You ask yourself, we're on this freight train to oblivion, and when does the train run out of fuel? And I'm at a loss because I sort of I jumped off the train so many years ago, and I'm not sure I'm giving you a satisfactory answer to your question. But those are my confused thoughts on it. Yes. Yes.
Yeah, I was very excited to come here. A friend of mine, Dr. Kalin, mentioned what the topic was. I think I superimposed your message by saying, whoa, the Holy Spirit is going to come to life big time in New England. I want to be here to hear the message. And basically saying that to evangelize, to step out, to talk about the laity is what we're supposed to do. The Great Commission, which I feel really doesn't get talked about in the churches.
Right.
At least the churches I've attended. 4 or 5 years ago, we heard that there was, I don't know if it was Georgia or Virginia. Virginia, but let's say some evangelicals that had a prophetic word show up more than once in their meetings, prayer meetings. And a number of them left their jobs, moved north to Massachusetts. I was able to somehow find out through a phone call or two, and I spoke to some young man working at Home Depot because he needed a job to pay rent. He was a guitar player. I never heard him playing, but he told me why they came up, and he mentioned to me that they had had a prophetic word down south, and they wanted to be here on the front line for it to happen. Okay? I'm all excited. My wife, my friends, it was wonderful. I never really saw anything of significance other than I went to Father DiLorenzo's... Massachusetts, I'm sorry to say name New England, but in Massachusetts, which was, of all the states, from a spiritual standpoint, we'll call it ground zero at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So when I heard you were going to talk about something that a renewal in New England, I said, well, now I think it's going to happen. So I heard the message 5 years ago, and now I'm hearing something here, and that's why I came.
Oh, I'm glad. I'm excited, too, because I'd never heard that before. And, I mean, the Holy Spirit moves in unpredictable ways and on his own schedule. And we mess up his schedule because we delay. But that's fascinating. It is fascinating that people would want to. You know, it's interesting. I talked about the Summer of Mercy in 1991. People going to Wichita. You know, Wichita is not a tourist attraction, frankly. And dead center of the United States, you know. The continental United States. And there were just a lot of people who felt that that was the place to be. I think it would be wonderful if people who think the way we think descended on New England and brought a little sanity, because heaven knows we could use it. Greg, you had your hand.
Yeah, I've been accused of seeking geographic cure. Professionally, I've lived for 10 years in Florida. I lived in North Carolina. Of course, I'm a native Bostonian and a native New England. And frankly, I found it much more rich and much more challenging to be a Catholic and much more fulfilling to be a Catholic in Florida. Or any time I've been in the South. I know where you're coming because I love, well, I'm kind of that person that hates the ground on which he can, like James Joyce. You know, Ireland's greatest export was men, we said, you know. And I find that it's very difficult terrain here for that. And I was at a church in Woodstock, Georgia, and I heard a priest get up, an elderly priest, a former army chaplain, speak about birth control, which I'd never heard from any pulpit up here, specifically about vasectomy. In a very compassionate way. So I kind of go with Flannery O'Connor, who somehow she felt her formation was enriched by her presence in the South, being a Catholic in the South. But that's probably just because I grew up in an enculturated, what they used to call Catholic ghetto,
mm-hmm.
where the faith is enculturated the way it was when I was growing up, it becomes more of them. And I think in a sense that's why we became the epicenter. For the sex abuse crisis, because we had a seminary that was educating guys, all of whom came from Boston. It was kind of a club. Mm. The faith was diminishing while that sense of ethnic cohesion was advancing. And the faith, any sense of faith, was dying while this sense of a club, and the club just disbanded in the 60s
right.
Under the pressure of the culture. And next thing you know, everybody in my family is not a Catholic anymore.
Right.
So I guess I'm hearing your call, I'm thinking maybe I need to stick around.
Yeah, you do. You know, when I was at the Pilot, I remember there was a piece in the New Yorker about the fellow who was the priest who was the rector of the seminary in Boston. And I don't know if he was the subject, I forget, but he was interviewed.
And he was asked, what are you trying to do? And he said, I want to produce good professional priests. And my blood curdled. God save me from professional priests. Yes?
Agreeing with everything you said, I hope the center that's being established considers the fact that we're not going to get any change until we reform the seminaries. And there was at some point, I'm sorry, I can't remember the exact point you were talking about, but I thought back to, you know, yes, lay leadership. I went through the proceeding. I went through the charismatic. Lay people can only do so much. We got to the point where priests just didn't. Good priests. I'm talking about good priests. I'm not. This is not a criticism.
Right.
It's not their fault. They come out of the seminary in a particular culture, which they were totally unconscious of having acquired. It's a culture that, as the deacons tell me, and I ask me some, don't even try to get through to them. We've been working with priests and parishes. In any case. So for 50 years, I've been trying to get through priests in terms of pastoral reform. It has to start from seminary. And I might want to say that in the last couple of years, there has been a change in response that I think. Now, they used to have people walk out.
Yes.
And say, you're an enemy of priests. You hate priests. And I don't get that anymore. I even get people agreeing with me now. And that's not the whole of the story. And again, it's not their fault.
It does, and, well, let me say several things, and I'll be brief in saying them. One of the reasons for hope that I see is young priests, because, you know, there were a lot of reasons to become a priest 60 years ago that have evaporated. You know, if you wanted 3 square meals and a black Buick, no heavy lifting, that road is blocked now. You're not going to do it just for a comfortable life. You will not have a comfortable life. I've met an awful lot of young priests who think very much the same way I do. Some of them, I feel like they didn't have the intellectual formation because they were taught by people my age. I do think that there is some substantial reason for optimism about the next generation of priests. Now, as for reforming the seminaries, I completely agree with you, but there's not much I can do other than any time I get a chance to talk to a bishop, try to put that bug in his ear, and that's not easy because bishops run away when they see me coming. But
you too?
Yeah. But beyond that, I have to say, yes, we have to reform the seminaries, but I can't reform the seminaries. I can just do what I can do. And for years I would give talks and people would hear my Boston accent. I would give talks around the country and people would hear the Boston accent and they would say, why doesn't he excommunicate Ted Kennedy? And I'd say, good question. Why don't you ask him? I mean, don't ask me.
I might say,
yes. Yes.
Only if they hear that from other priests is it going to be successful.
That's true.
You know, and we can get convinced, as the other day, I think I succeeded in convincing one priest to talk to other priests.
Okay. Yeah, well done.
Step in the right direction.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
Oh.
Thank you very much. Sorry.
That's it. Oh, okay. That all came through.